All right, hello everyone. Welcome back to Human Unite. Let me try that a second time. Take two. Beep, beep. Hello everyone. Welcome back to Human, Humanity's United Martial Arts Network. Joined back, my good friend and co-host, Marcus Kofal. How you doing today, Marcus?
I'm good. I'm really excited about today's podcast. We've had some amazing people on here, but today's guest, I'm going to let him speak himself in a second, but I want to give you guys a background. There's an amazing book out there called Red Notice. If you've read it, you already know Mr. Bill Browder. If you have not, pick up a copy and you will learn about everything from heartbreak to courage, grit, financier, and being a true activist, as well as international politics. And Mr. Bill Browder, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Great to be here. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I have so many questions for you. I don't even know where to start, to be honest. But let's go back to when it all started. You were the first American, even though you don't live in the United States now, but you were the first American to invest in what's today, modern days Russia, when the Soviet Union was falling and was becoming privatized and made billions for a lot of people. You're a true entrepreneur. You have gone to places that no one else has. What do you accredit that to? Where did this passion and this drive come from?
Well, I have a very strange family background. My grandfather, who is also American, was a labor union organizer from Wichita, Kansas, and in the 1920s. And he was so good at organizing the labor union that the communists spotted him from Russia. And they said, if you like labor unionism, you're going to love communism. Why don't you come to Moscow and check it out? So my grandfather, in 1927, went to Moscow. And he did what most red-blooded single American men do when they get to Moscow. He found a Russian girl, became my grandmother. My father was born out there. And then 5 years later, they returned to America, and my grandfather became head of the American Communist Party. He ran for president of America against Roosevelt in 1936 and 1940 as a communist. He was put in jail in 1941, pardoned in 1942. He was then kicked out of the Communist Party in 1945 for being too much of a capitalist, and then viciously persecuted in the 1950s, during the McCarthy era, for being a communist. So I was born in 1964, 55, almost 56 years old. But when I was going through my teenage rebellion, I was trying to figure out a great way of rebelling from this family of communists. And I tried a couple things. I grew my hair long, and it turned into an afro. But strangely, that didn't upset my family. I followed the Grateful Dead around the country for a few months, and that didn't upset my family. But then I figured out the perfect way of upsetting my family, which was to put on a suit and tie and become a capitalist. And that really upset my family very badly. And I became a capitalist, and I went to Stanford Business School in 1987. And I graduated in 1989, and that was the year that the Berlin Wall came down. And as I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, one day I had this epiphany, which is that if my grandfather was the biggest communist in America and the Berlin Wall has just come down, I'm going to try to become the biggest capitalist in Eastern Europe. And that's what I set out to do. And I didn't get as far as Eastern Europe in the first go. I moved to London in 1989. But eventually I was able to find my way into being a capitalist in Eastern Europe, and I set up an investment fund in Russia to invest in the newly privatized companies of Russia at the beginning of the Russian privatization program.
And looking at what you did, you made billions of dollars on the privatization of former Soviet Union, and at some point, you ended up. Was it your success that ultimately got the wrong people's attention? Would you say, where you very early on stood up for what you thought was right.
So,
against powerful people.
Well, so exactly. So what happened was, so I started with zero. I was like a total nobody when I got out there, but I was the only one doing it. And I and at the time they were giving everything away for free to the people of Russia, and you could buy shares of companies from people who got the shares at like a 99.7% discount. And so I set up this investment fund to invest out there, buying these cheap, super cheap shares. And it was really like the Wild West. I mean, it was like, you know, gold rush. You know, you could make literally 10 times your money in 2 days just because nobody knew what was going on. It was just a free-for-all. So I set up this investment fund, and it was just going gangbusters. And everybody started wanting to give me money to manage, and my fund became the largest investment fund in the country. And the trouble was that it was all very exciting and the shares were going up and all this kind of stuff. But it turned out that all the companies that we invested in, all the money was getting stolen out the back door by these people known as the Russian oligarchs. They would control the companies, and maybe I'd have a 1% share, they'd have a 51% share, but they were stealing 100% of the money. And they're stealing assets, and they're doing all this kind of stuff. And I said to myself, this is not profitable to have them steal all the money, and it's definitely not right, and I need to do something about it. But the problem is, in Russia, you know, it's not like you can go to the police and say, hey, look at these crooks, they're stealing, because the police are all on their payroll. And you can't go to the government, to the regulator, and to their SEC and say, look, they're all stealing because the SEC is on their payroll. You can't go to the parliament and say they're stealing because the parliament's on their payroll. Everybody is like, it's all one big corrupt scheme. And so I only had one thing I could do, which was I was really good at researching companies because that's what we did for a living. And so we started to do what I call stealing analysis. We were trying to figure out how the stealing happened to the companies. And so we would do stealing analysis of these companies. And then the other thing I did was I hung around the same restaurants and bars as the foreign correspondents for all the major newspapers. All the expats hung out in the same places. And so I'd take my stealing analysis and I would share it with the guy from the Wall Street Journal. And he thought, wow, this is great. You know, you just saved me 3 months worth of work. I can just use your stuff and write it up. And so I would do what I call naming and shaming campaigns, where we would find out who was stealing, how they were stealing, where they were, you know, re-registering stuff into, and what name, and so on. And then I give it to the Wall Street Journal, or the New York Times, to the Financial Times, and then they write it up. And then all of a sudden, they would write it up, and then like the Russian press would like write stories about their stories, and I started doing this at the same time that Vladimir Putin had just come to power, and I didn't realize this when I started doing it, but Vladimir Putin had the same problem I had. The oligarchs who were stealing money from me were stealing power from him. When he became president of Russia at the very beginning, he wasn't very powerful because all the power was held by these oligarchs who had all these people on their payroll. And so he wanted to get his power back. And there's this expression, your enemy's enemy is your friend. And I've never met Vladimir Putin up until this day. But because we were both enemies with the oligarchs, every time that I would publicize one of these scandals, he would step in and fire somebody using the government's shares or issue a presidential decree or do some type of pretty drastic action. And every time he would do that, the share price would rise. So, I mean, it was like a perfect situation. So my share price was going, the shares were going up. We were getting the bad guys, making Russia a better place. It couldn't have been more perfect. The problem was that he wasn't doing it for the right reason. He was doing it because he didn't like the oligarchs. And eventually, he decided he wanted to win his war with the oligarchs once and for all. And so what did he do? He identified the richest oligarch. It was a guy named Mikhail Hordakovsky. Hordakovsky was worth like $15 or $20 billion. He owned a big oil company called Yukos. And Hordakovsky was flying his private plane, and he landed in Siberia. And Putin surrounded the plane with secret policemen. They stormed the plane. They grabbed Hordakovsky off the plane. They flew him back to Moscow. They put him on trial in Moscow. And in Russia, when you go on trial, there's a 99.7% conviction rate. So there's no presumption of innocence there. And they just put you in a cage because that's where you're going to be after the trial's over. And so they allowed the television cameras to come into the court and film the richest guy in Russia sitting in a cage. Now, imagine you're the 17th richest guy in Russia. You're on your yacht. It's parked off the Hotel du Cap in Antibes, France. You just finished up with your mistress in the bedroom. You wander out to the living room. You flick on CNN. And there you see a guy far richer, far smarter, far more powerful than you sitting in a cage. What's your natural reaction? You don't want to sit in that cage yourself. Yeah. And so after Hordakovsky was convicted and sentenced to jail for 10 years, the other oligarchs went to Putin and said, Vladimir, what do we have to do so we don't sit in a cage? Putin said, real simple, 50%. Not 50% for the Russian government, not 50% for the presidential administration of Russia, 50% for Vladimir Putin. And at that point, he became the richest man in Russia and the richest man in the world.
Yeah. So, you know, there's an old saying, don't poke the bear. You definitely did the right thing, as we know today. But living in Russia, being aware of how Russia worked, at the time, did you realize how deep this ran as far as corruption and so on?
Well, at that point, you know, in order for a guy from south side of Chicago to show up in Russia and to challenge oligarchs on stealing billions of dollars, you kind of have to sand off your risk sensors and just go in. You just have to sort of go in head first. Because, you know, just even showing up there was something considered to be so crazy, so risky, and so unusual that you just, you can't be thinking of all the things that are going to go wrong. You kind of have to think, I'm just going to go in head first and just see it, you know, and just, you know, damn the torpedoes kind of thing. And that's what I did. And so I wasn't sort of trying to like read all the tea leaves at any point during my time there, because if I had, I wouldn't have been able to do any, I wouldn't have showed up there and I wouldn't have been able to do any of the things I did. And so for a while, it all worked really nicely, until it didn't work at all.
So, you know, I am a fighter, and I used to travel when I lived in England. We had two Russians that were on that. We had a kickboxing team that traveled around England and competed with. One from Kyrgyzstan, one from Moscow, and they would always talk about this, but almost like a joke, you know, the Russian mafia, and you weren't sure if it was real, if it was a myth, but now, after many years of friendship, after reading your book, we know how real it is, but even as a fighter, both going into a country that no one, and you didn't stop, you had many no's. Ultimately, when you started having the success, you had some of the biggest billionaires in the world investing with you. But when things started going south, where did you develop this fighting spirit? Is, I guess, my question. Where did you find that? Where I'm not gonna take no for an answer. I don't care if you have guns and goons are gonna come after me. Where did that come from?
You know, I wish that there was some, like, you know, easy answer that I like, you know, was taking certain vitamins and that caused me to be this way. For me, it was kind of like, you know, I had gone out there to build my business. I went out there, took a lot of risks to get there. And I just kind of thought, you know, I'm not going to let these guys get away with this. And there was this, you know, part of what these oligarchs were up to was real dangerous power, and part of it was bluffing. I mean, it's like a kind of like a prison yard in Russia, and everybody is walking around acting as tough as they could possibly be, and they can't show any weakness. But they're not that. I mean, they were powerful, very dangerous. Lots of terrible things ended up happening, which we haven't even touched on yet. But a lot of it is also bluff. And that's one of the things I discovered, is that, like, we had success fighting with one of these oligarchs, and maybe that success in a certain way was really terribly dangerous for me, because then I got more brazen and more self-confident and taking on bigger oligarchs and bigger gangsters. And in the end, on November 13th, 2005, I was flying back to Moscow after coming to a weekend trip to London, and I'd been living there for 10 years, and I was the largest foreign investor in the country. And I arrived at Sheremetyevo Airport, which is the main international airport, and I traveled in and out so often that I had a special card for their VIP lounge, and went to the VIP lounge, and which is where, you know, normally it would take like a minute or whatever to get through immigration, and they had me sit there for an hour. So I knew something was wrong, and then all of a sudden, four heavily armed border guards burst in, grab me, arrest me, and frog march me down to the detention center of the airport and lock me up. And at this point, I didn't know whether I was being arrested or deported. And I'm sitting there overnight thinking about all the, like, the question you asked, like, maybe I poked the bear too much, and they're going to send me out to Siberia for the next 10 years. I was just terrified. And I sat there, the next morning I figured, you know, if I'm being deported, there was an 11 o'clock flight to London. I figured, you know, that maybe they come and get me at 9:30. So I'm banging on the bars at 9:30, and of course the guards are just ignoring me. And I figure, you know, well, I mean, they must need an hour at least to process me or whatever they're going to do. And so 10 o'clock comes around, still nobody is caring about me. And as we're getting closer to 11 o'clock, I'm thinking, if they're not putting me on that flight, I'm going to be, this is not a deportation, this is an arrest. And 10:15, they're still not coming for me. 10:30, I've got, like, you know, adrenaline pumping through my veins as I'm picturing, you know, going off to Siberia. 10:40, still nothing. 10:42, they finally come and grab me, front march me up to the Aeroflot plane, throw me in a middle seat on the Aeroflot plane, and the plane takes off. And I don't know if you've ever seen that movie Argo, where they save these, where the Canadian diplomats finally get out of Iran. But when that plane finally got into the air, I just felt the biggest relief I've ever felt in my life, which was that I was being deported and not arrested and sent off to Siberia. And it was the biggest relief ever. And then when I finally landed in London, we tried to figure out why is it that they had deported me. And we wrote to the foreign ministry, and they wrote me back a letter saying, you've been deported because you've been declared a threat to national security of Russia. You're not allowed to come back in. Now, normally that would be a pretty bad thing as a specialist investor in Russia with the largest investment fund in the country. But I was saying to myself, well, when the Russians turn on you, they don't tend to do so mildly. They usually do with extreme prejudice. And being kicked out of the country, that's a pretty mild sanction. So I said to myself, what else could they do to me? And the answer is that I had a big team of people in Moscow, a lot of Russians and their family members, a few foreigners. And we had a lot of money over there, a lot of money invested in their markets. And I thought, you know, we evacuated. We did organize an emergency evacuation, and I got out every single one of my employees plus all of their dependents, got every one of them out of the country, and got them to London. And then once they got them to London, we then organized to sell everything we held in the country as quickly and quietly as we could. And we were able to get all of our assets out of the country. And I thought, that's a huge relief, you know, because they really, you know, there's not much they can really do to me now. And I thought that's the end of my story with Russia. Maybe I'll write a book about it someday or something, and went on to do other things. Well, I thought it was the end of my story in Russia. It was just the beginning of the worst nightmare you could ever imagine. Yeah.
And I do want to get to it. You did get your people out of the country, but there was another man with just as much courage who refused to give in to the wrong forces, and that was Sergei Magnitsky, who is the foundation of the act talk about in a bit, a close friend of yours who refused to give in. Tell us a little bit more about Sergeant.
So after I was expelled from Russia, about 18 months afterwards, I get a call from I kept my office in Moscow. I prepaid for it. There's one secretary sitting there, and I get a call from the secretary saying, Bill, the office is being raided right now by 25 police officers. What should I do? And I said, I'm not sure. So I called my lawyer, and he sounded really distracted. I said, my office is being raided right now. What should I do? And he said, I don't know. My office is being raided right now by 25 police officers looking for your documents. I'll call you back. So on June 4th, 2007, 50 officers were raiding both my office and my law firm's office. They were specifically looking for all the corporate documents for our investment holding companies, which at this point were empty. Remember, we had sold everything, but they didn't know that. And they got all those documents at our law firm's office. They took them. And then the next thing we know, that we no longer own our investment holding companies, our empty investment holding companies, because our investment holding companies, we had liquidated everything. They had been fraudulently re-registered using the documents seized by the police during these raids. And not just that, they were re-registered into the name of a man who had been convicted of murder and let out of jail early by the police. Presumably he put his name on these documents. So at this point, I was terrified, not for economic reasons, because remember, I got my money safely out of the country, but I was terrified for legal reasons, that if the police were working with murderers to steal companies, someday I'll be traveling through Frankfurt Airport and I'll be arrested on a Russian warrant. We need to get this thing, we need to figure out what they're doing and shut it down. And so I went out and hired the smartest lawyer I knew in Russia, who was a young man named Sergei Magnitsky. Sergei Magnitsky was 35 years old. He worked for an American law firm, and he was one of these guys that could do 10 things in the time it took others to do one. He was just a genius. He could run circles around everybody. So I hire Sergei and say, figure this out and help me stop it. And so Sergei goes out, he investigates, and he comes back. He said, I figured out what they wanted to do. There are two parts of the scam. First, they wanted to steal all of your money, but you got all your money out, so they didn't get any money. He said, however, the second part of the scam did work, and the second part of the scam was truly cynical. So when I had sold all of the stuff in the previous year, taking all our money out of Russia, we had $1 billion of profit. And on that $1 billion of profit, we paid $230 million of taxes to the Russian government. And what Sergei had figured out was that the people who stole our companies went back to the tax authorities on the 23rd of December, 2007. And they filed an amended tax return. And they said, there was a mistake made in the previous year's tax filing. These companies didn't earn $1 billion. They earned zero. And they came up with a complicated way of explaining that. Hmm. And they said, therefore, the $230 million of taxes that was paid last year was paid in error. And they said, we want that money back. And they applied for a $230 million illegal tax refund on the 23rd of December, 2007, 2 days before Christmas. And it was paid out to the fraudsters the next day, no questions asked. It was the largest tax refund in the history of Russia, paid out in one day on a fraud on Christmas Eve. And so Sergei and I were both convinced this must be a rogue operation. We thought Vladimir Putin he might be a crook, but he's a patriot and a nationalist. He would never, and this wasn't our money that was being stolen. This was the Russian government's money. And so we figured that if we just got this to the attention of the highest levels in Russia, then the good guys would get the bad guys. And so we wrote criminal complaints to the head of every different law enforcement agency in Russia. I went to the TV, radio, newspapers. And then Sergei went to the Russian State Investigative Committee, which is their version of the FBI, and he gave a sworn testimony against the police officers who conducted the raid to seize the documents that were used in the fraud. And then we sat back and waited for the good guys to get the bad guys. But it turns out that in Vladimir Putin's government, there are no good guys. 5 weeks after Sergei testified against these police officers, the same police officers came to his home on the morning of November 24th, 2008, and they arrested Sergei, and they threw him in jail. And in jail, he was then tortured to withdraw his testimony. They put him in cells with 14 inmates in 8 beds and left lights on 24 hours a day with sleep deprivation. They threw him in cells with no window panes in unheated cells in December in Moscow, and so where he nearly froze to death. They threw him in cells with no toilet, just a hole in the floor where the sewage would bubble up. They'd move him from cell to cell to cell in the middle of the night. And the purpose of all this was to try to get him to withdraw his testimony against the corrupt police officers. And they wanted to get him to sign a false confession to say that he stole the $230 million, and he did so on my instruction. And they figured, here's a guy, he wears a blue suit and a red tie and a white shirt, buys Starbucks coffee in the morning and sits in a fancy Western law firm, he'll buckle within a week. But they totally, and he doesn't look like some kind of tough guy, but they totally misjudged Sergei Magnitsky. He was like, he had a will of steel. And for him, the idea of perjuring himself, bearing false witness, and selling out his integrity was more painful than any of the physical things that they were subjecting him to. And he just refused. And they didn't know what to do with him, and they just kept on escalating and doing more terrible things. And after about 6 months of this, his health started to break down. He started getting terrible, terrible pains in his stomach, started losing weight. He lost about 40 pounds, and he was eventually diagnosed as having pancreatitis and gallstones. And he was scheduled to have an operation on the 1st of August, 2009. About a week before that operation, his tormentors came to him again and again asked him to sign a false confession. And again, he refused. In retaliation, they abruptly moved him from the prison that had a medical wing where the operation was supposed to take place to a maximum security prison called Butyrka, which is considered to be one of the toughest prisons in Russia. And most significantly for Sergei, they had no medical facilities there. And at Butyrka, his health completely broke down. He went into a terrible downward spiral. He was in sort of constant, agonizing, ear-piercing pain from untreated pancreatitis and gallstones. And this is an ailment that if any normal person gets it, you know, you can't last 2 hours before you're in the ER, in the ICU with getting morphine injections while they try to take care of it for you. He was in this situation for months, untreated pancreatitis, and it was just got worse and worse and worse. He and his lawyers wrote requests, desperate requests, to every different branch of the criminal justice system, begging for medical attention. And every different branch of the criminal justice system either ignored his requests or denied them in writing. And finally, his body could no longer take it. And on the night of November 16, 2009, he went into critical condition. The Butyrka authorities didn't want to have responsibility for him anymore, and they put him in an ambulance and sent him to a prison that had a medical wing. When he arrived at the prison with a medical wing, instead of putting him in the emergency room, they put him in an isolation cell. They chained him to a bed, and 8 riot guards with rubber batons beat Sergei Magnitsky until he died. He was 37 years old. He left a wife and 2 children. I got the news the next morning, and it was the most painful, traumatic, life-changing news I could have ever gotten. Sergei Magnitsky was effectively killed as my proxy. If he hadn't been working for me, he'd still be alive today. And when I was finally able to get through the fog of heartbreak and hysteria to think clearly, it was obvious I had only one thing I could do, which was to put aside everything else I was doing and devote all of my time, all of my resources, and all of my energies to going after the people who killed him and make sure that they faced justice. And for the last 10 and a half years, that's what I've been doing.
It's so crazy to both hear about a country being able to do that to another human being. But like you said, a man who wears a suit, works with paperwork, usually having that warrior spirit to stand up for what is right while enduring both torture and his sickness, where I lost for words. But when you said you put everything else aside, you truly did put everything else aside. You were making a lot of money. You must have feared for your own life at this point. And you said, to hell with it. I'm going to do what I can in Sergei's name. And you did.
So I've made it my life's mission to go after the people who killed him. And at first we thought we could possibly get justice in Russia. Sergei did something very unusual, which is he wrote it all down. During his time in detention, during his 358 days in detention, he documented everything they did to him in the form of criminal complaints. He wrote 450 criminal complaints in his 358 days in detention. And he documented who did what to him, where, how, when, and why. And because of that, and he would file, he would take these complaints once a month, hand them to his lawyer. His lawyer would file them. They would reject them or ignore them. But I got copies of all these complaints. And so I figured that we could get justice even inside of Russia because the story was so outrageous. And we used, and this was by far the most well-documented human rights abuse case come out of Russia in the last 35 or 40 years. But it turned out that in spite of the absolute mountain of documentary evidence, the Russian authorities completely circled the wagons. Vladimir Putin got personally involved, and he exonerated everybody who played a role in this terrible thing. And they gave state honors and promotions to some of the people who were most complicit. And they even put Sergei Magnitsky himself on trial 3 years after they killed him, the first trial against a dead man in the history of Russia. And it became obvious to me that there was no possibility of getting justice inside of Russia. So I said, we need to get justice outside of Russia. But how do you get justice outside of Russia? The reality is that there were no tools to do that. This kind of stuff, there's nothing you can do. And I just was not willing to live with that. I was not willing to accept that there was no tools that I could use to get justice. And so I looked at this whole situation. I said, look, the people who killed Sergei Magnitsky didn't do it for ideological reasons or religious reasons. They killed him for money. They killed him for $230 million. And that money, they don't keep in Russia. As easily as they stole it, it could be stolen from them. They keep that money in the West, in New York, in London, Geneva, and Zurich. They buy houses in South Beach and on the villas in the Côte d'Azur, and townhouses in Belgrave Square in London. They send their girlfriends on shopping trips to Milan and their kids to school in boarding school in England and their parents to Harley Street doctors. And I said to myself, we may not be able to prosecute them in the West, but we should at least not allow them to come to the West and spend their money in the West. And so I went to Washington in April of 2010, and I set up a meeting with a Democratic senator from Maryland named Benjamin Cardin and a Republican senator from Arizona, late John McCain. I sat down with these two senators, and I told them the same story that I'm sharing with you today. And I said, can we ban their visas and freeze their assets? And they said, yeah. And that became known as the Magnitsky Act. And the Magnitsky Act freezes the assets and bans the visas of the people who killed Sergei Magnitsky and the people who do similar horrible things like that in Russia. And at the time we did this, it took about 2 years from start to finish, but when it went for a vote in the U.S. Senate, it passed the Senate 92-4. It was totally bipartisan. It passed the House of Representatives with 89%. And on December 14, 2012, the Sergei Magnitsky Act became a federal law in the United States. And Vladimir Putin went out of his mind. This is the first time that there have been sanctions against Russia in the last 40 years. Vladimir Putin is, I believe, one of the richest men in the world, and he has a lot of money outside the country, and he's a human rights abuser. And for him, money is more valuable than human life. And so for him, the idea that I could put his personal fortune at risk was like almost too much for him. In retaliation for the Magnitsky Act being passed, he banned the adoption of Russian orphans by American families. And I should point out that the orphans that were being adopted were the sick ones, the ones that Americans were bringing back to America and nursing them to health, the ones who died in the orphanages in Russia. And so he's effectively sentencing his own orphans to death in order to protect his money and his corrupt cronies' money. And he was so upset after that, he made repealing the Magnitsky Act his single largest foreign policy priority. And there was a famous meeting in Trump Tower, June 9th, 2016, where a Russian lawyer representing Vladimir Putin went to Trump Tower to meet with Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort. This was before Trump was president. With one request, which is that if Trump gets elected, could they repeal the Magnitsky Act? Now, I'm happy to say that has not happened. And not only that, but we've since globalized the Magnitsky Act. It doesn't just apply to Russian bad guys anymore. In 2016, the global Magnitsky Act was passed. It applies to bad guys everywhere in the world, Chinese bad guys and in Myanmar and Venezuela and all sorts of other places. After the United States passed the global Magnitsky Act, the Canadian Parliament unanimously passed the Canadian Magnitsky Act. And the British Parliament passed the British Magnitsky Act. The Estonian Parliament, the Lithuanian Parliament, the Latvian Parliament, the Kosovo Parliament. We now have 7 Magnitsky Acts, and the EU is on deck, Australia is on deck, and pretty soon, I believe, that every civilized country in the world will have a Magnitsky Act. And Vladimir Putin and all sorts of other dictators are pulling their hair out because these guys commit terrible crimes in their country. They torture people. They kill people. And then they want to spend their money in the West. And we're now shutting down the West for these guys.
And Bill, what does this act say exactly?
It says that if you're a human rights abuser or a kleptocrat, your assets will be frozen and your visa will be canceled. And if you're a kleptocrat doing terrorism in African country or wherever, the only reason you do the terrible things is for money, so you can go to the south of France or South Beach or Aspen or wherever. And all of a sudden, we're shutting down the world for these people. And not only that, but when you get put on the sanctions list, no bank wants to touch you anymore. You can't travel. You can't open accounts. Mm. Your family has trouble. And all of a sudden, you become recognized as the bad guy, as the criminal that you are. And that didn't exist before. And it's all in the name of Sergei Magnitsky. And so Sergei Magnitsky has paid the ultimate price. At the age of 37, with an amazing life ahead of him, with a beautiful, wonderful wife, with amazing children, he gave up. But his name will be remembered forever as the person who is hopefully going to save lives, because these bad guys, there's now a consequence for doing terrible things.
So I, from doing the work that I do my son's name, as far as trying to change the laws of lowering the blood alcohol content in the United States, I know how difficult it is to get an act passed or a bill passed, and to do it with the numbers that you said, 89% in the House of Representatives, it's unheard of. But in the book, you kind of brushed by it, but when it was recognized in the European Parliament, you brought Sergei's wife and son with you, and you were there as guests, and the whole European Parliament turned around and applauded as they passed. It gives me goosebumps just thinking about it. You have also, because of it, become known as Vladimir Putin's worst enemy. And I would think a lot of people would consider Vladimir Putin the most dangerous man in the world.
He's a very bad man. He's a very dangerous man. And he really, really doesn't like me. And I've been threatened with death, kidnapping. They've used Interpol 8 times to have me arrested. I was arrested in Madrid two summers ago. I was detained in Switzerland. They've tried to have me extradited from England. They've sued me all over the world. They've opened up multiple criminal cases against me in Russia. I've been sentenced to 18 years in prison in absentia in Russia. And there's many more criminal cases that are currently being prosecuted against me. I mean, he's got a real problem with me. Some people would say, well, why do you do it? And the answer is because I couldn't live with myself if I didn't do what I'm doing. You know, a young man's life was taken in my service, would still be alive today if he wasn't working for me. And for me, that responsibility weighs on me every day. And the only way that I can have peace is by going after the people who did this to him and making sure that they pay a very profound price. And they have. And I'd rather do what I've done with the great risks that I take than be a coward and walk away. I couldn't do that. I couldn't live with myself.
And when you said that the risk is real, when I read in the book and what you talked about which is actually the name of your book, Red Notice, which is a code in Interpol for international, basically a warrant for your arrest. And,
correct.
And as you mentioned, you were detained in Spain with a potential risk of whatever country that you're in extraditing you to Russia, where you know that if you do go to jail in Russia, there's a good chance you won't see daylight again.
I'll be killed if I go to Russia. And so I've got to be extremely careful about where I travel to. And even when I am careful, it sometimes doesn't work. I was going to Spain 2 summers ago at the invitation of the chief anti-corruption prosecutor of Spain in order to give him evidence to help him build a case against the people who had been laundering the money that Sergei Magnitsky was killed over. And the morning that I was going to have my meeting with him, a different division of the Spanish police come to my hotel and arrest me on a Russian Interpol warrant. Now, thankfully, I'm a big Twitter user, and I tweeted out that I was being arrested. And it created such a shitstorm around the world as people saw this happening in real time that a couple hours later, after 50 journalists called Interpol and said, what are you doing? They called up the Spanish police and said, Bill Browder should be released. But every time I cross a border, that could be the moment that I get arrested. That could be the moment that they then put in motion a situation where they send me back to Russia. So, there is true catastrophe risk, every day of my life.
And you live with a real constant death threat. It must be a dark cloud over your head. And one case that we haven't spoken about was in Surrey, I think it was 2006. Another gentleman who was involved in the work that you were doing was found dead with the circumstances. Still, I think his cause of death is still declared unknown. And I remember when it happened, and a close friend of mine who lives in Surrey, outside of London, I called him the same day when I read that in your book. And I said, do you remember this case? He said, yeah, that was down the street from me. And it was in the tabloids in England when it happened. That death threat that you have hanging over you, what is it like to live with that?
Well, it's something which you kind of get used to after a while. So it's not like if you're living in a war zone, you can't spend every day thinking I'm going to die, a bomb is going to drop on me. You kind of have to get used to it. I mean, I have to take precautions. I do a lot of things that a normal person won't do. But I don't spend every day thinking something terrible is going to happen. I spend every day thinking about how am I going to pursue the people who killed Sergei Magnitsky. That's what I'm thinking about. I'm not living in fear. Because if you live in fear, then they've accomplished 90% of their goal already. And it's not easy to live like the way I live, but this is how I choose to live. And I survived so far. This has been going on for 10 years. So I don't know if I'm going to survive tomorrow, but I've survived 10 years, and I feel, you know, I feel good about what I do. I feel like I have a mission in life and something meaningful what I'm doing. And it may not be pleasant. It may end horribly abruptly, but I've lived a meaningful life whenever it ends.
And reading the book, at times it almost feels like you're taunting Putin. And I'm thinking to myself, why would you let this out? But you mention in the book, that's your safe card, potentially. Because if anything would ever happen to you, the rest of the world would know why and who did it. And one thing that you don't mention, I have to tell you, actually, my dad read your book. And he sent a copy of your book to me and my two brothers, which he has never done with any book before. And he tells everyone, he was born in Poland where you made your first investment, came to Sweden at the age of 16. But when I mentioned that you were going to be on our podcast here, my brother who lives in Sweden still, who's a lawyer in Sweden, said, do me a favor, please. Can you please ask Bill about, when you talked about an international shitstorm. You caused an international shitstorm by proving or showing that the Swedish bank, Swedbank, was one of the banks that laundered Russian money. The little country of Sweden were laundering Russian oligarchs or criminals' money. How did you even find that trace?
Well, the other big project that we've been working on for 10 years is who got the money that Sergei Magnitsky was killed over. And I wanted to make sure that anyone who got that money has that money taken away from them by the government. And anyone who helped them, anyone who assisted them, anyone who laundered it, gets prosecuted to the maximum extent of the law. And so for 10 years, I and my team have been tracing the money. And we found a lot of it. And we found that money going to a lot of different countries, including Sweden, Denmark, Norway, UK, France, Switzerland. It's gone everywhere. And every time we find it, we then file complaints with law enforcement authorities of those countries. Some of them open criminal investigations. Some of them don't. And some of the money gets seized and frozen. Some of it doesn't. But in the process of the whole thing, we discovered that Denmark and Sweden were two of the main hubs of money laundering. The Danske Bank was laundered something like $230 billion from Russia and the former Soviet Union, and Swedbank and Nordea Bank and a bunch of other banks were all part of this syndicate. And they were all, you know, wearing their nice ties and acting all upright and appropriate. And these are countries that are supposed to be some of the most honest countries in the world. Denmark is like number two on the Transparency International Honesty Index.
Do you think they're
I guarantee you. So, I mean, just to give you an example. So the money went through a branch of Danske Bank in Estonia. And that branch, so normally banking is a profitable business, but not that profitable. Normally you have like let's say a 15% return. Their Estonian branch had a 400% return. So if you're the CEO and you see a 400% return, you say, how did they make all that money? And like, I mean, either he was the dumbest guy in the world or he knew.
Yeah. Yeah. Your courage, your fight for your friend, who paid, like you said, the ultimate price, is encouraging. It's impressive. It's inspiring. I have you hear stories and you read in books and you watch movies, reading your book, it could have been a fictional book, but it isn't. That this has been your life. You have now brought down, like you said, some of the, not just Russian bad guys, but bad guys around the world. How does Bill Browdy live 10 years from now?
Well, you know, once you get into this business of fighting the bad guys, there's a lot of bad guys out there, and you know, the Magnitsky story is still central to my life, but everyone else, I hear a lot of other stories. Yeah. And you know, I was in Washington about a year ago, and someone said, you have to meet this woman, she's got an absolutely horrifying story. And she came to me, and she was a reporter for something called Radio Free Asia, which is a U.S. radio station that reports on China and various other places. And she was from the Uyghur region, of the Muslim region, in Xinjiang in China. And she was the one, she told me, that she had been the one to break the story about the concentration camps that they've set up for this Muslim minority in China, and where a million people, or maybe more, were put in concentration camps. And this is like last year. This is not 1945. This is last year in concentration camps. She broke that story, and 40 of her family members, all of her family members, were arrested and put into the concentration camps for her breaking that story. How can I not get involved?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so...
Now, go ahead, sir.
You know, and so, you know, these things just, you know, there's, it just, it's hard, it's, you know, you hear these stories, and it's hard not to get involved.
Yeah. With the coronavirus that's currently going on, and there's a lot of conspiracy theories, and obviously coming out of China, and you live in England, where the coronavirus is a very real threat. When you hear these conspiracies, especially in America, you are American born, and a lot of these conspiracy theories come out of America. What do you think when you hear about all the different variations of them?
Well, I'm not a big believer generally in conspiracy theories. However, there's one thing that I know for sure, which is that the Chinese government, like the Russian government, is a dictatorship. They're dishonest. And they were dishonest about the problems with the coronavirus that they were having. And they lied about the extent to which there was an epidemic and the death rate and the number of people who are dying and so on. Had they told the truth, we might have been more alarmed here in the UK, in Italy, and various other places. And maybe we would have taken greater precautions and closed down airports and locked down situations earlier, and maybe we'd have a lot less dead people. And so I think that the dishonesty of dictators has led to this particular thing. And that's not a conspiracy theory. That's just, you know, it facts in your face. The conspiracy theories are about, you know, who, does someone weaponize this virus or whatever? I don't know. But what I tell you for sure is that the Chinese lied about it, and because of that, a lot of people have died, and they really should be held account for this total dictatorship lying that they were doing early on.
Yeah. It's, again, Bill, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. Thank you for the work that you're doing, your courage, and for inspiring people, including myself. Like I said to you privately, you know, I'm up against giants fighting the fight I'm fighting in the U.S., but you've proven that you can make a change as long as you keep that courage and don't take no for an answer. We usually end the podcast asking the guest something that they can advise our listeners to do, whether it's a daily habit or to make changes.
Well, the one thing I would say is that everybody, as you said, any one individual can make a difference. And everyone feels very powerless against big institutions and so on. But any one person, and I'm a prime example, I'm not a a fighter. I'm not a physical fighter like you guys. But I fought the bad guys, and I hit them hard. And anyone can do it if they believe in themselves.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's hard not to get emotional to hear your story, Joe. And for those that haven't, go out, read Red Notice. It will be an exciting book to read, and it's very, very inspiring. And it gives you the opportunity to open up your eyes and be thankful for living in countries where that type of lifestyle isn't common daily practice. So, Bill, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Bill, thank you for your time. Thank you for your bravery, sir.
Thank you. Have a great day, guys.
Thank you. You too. Thanks.